The tribe of Levi had a long tradition in Israel of being set apart to the service of God. There was nothing in that distinction that arose in any way from anything that the progenitor of that tribe had done. Levi and Simeon had been the sons of Jacob, who had betrayed an agreement their father had made with Shechem and had revenged their sister's honor, so they thought, by engaging in an act of unspeakable horror. They slaughtered those who believed that they had made peace with Israel and his sons. Jacob never really forgave Levi and Simeon for their act. You can read Jacob's last blessing upon his sons, and you will find that even at that point, years afterward, he still had it very vividly in his mind. He said on that occasion that they had made his name to stink among the inhabitants of the land. It was not a very auspicious beginning, you will agree, for a tribe that was to be marked, at least in theory, for its holiness to the Lord. But the sovereign grace of God is such that the descendants of Levi did become those who were the priests, the servants of the house of God. Those of the tribe that were not actually in the line of the priests were still charged with taking care of the house of God. That was the design that God set before them. But the declension caused by apostasy in Israel did not bypass the sons of Levi. As the nation slid farther and farther from the right ways of Jehovah, the sons of Levi themselves became enmeshed in the network of false religion that ultimately brought down both kingdoms. First that of Israel, the northern kingdom, and later the southern kingdom of Judah. So that the men, the sons of Levi, who should have been acting as guides and guards for the people against the corrosive influences of idolatry, who should have been speaking against the kings, began to curry favor instead with the royal house and often did the bidding of the kings instead of following the commandments of the Lord. Now, to be sure, there were some sons of Levi who did right. And through the history of the kingdom of Judah in particular, you can read about some of them. Jehoiada the priest, for example, they did right. They tried to introduce reforms that would bring the people back to the right way, the way of worshiping Jehovah. But too often there was not strong royal leadership, and without that leadership, the efforts of those Levites tended to be frustrated. The people grew to equate the Levites with the service of God. So they looked upon the Levites and they said, well, whatever the Levites are doing, we can follow safely that example. So when the Levites began to follow the ways of idolatry, the people followed their example. Even after the return from the Babylonian captivity, an experience that pretty well cured the children of Judah from returning to idolatry, even then the people of Judah found it hard to shake entirely the tendency of the previous generations. They were enamored with compromise. And they found the way of wholly following the Lord to be somewhat distasteful. So the people of Malachi's day, following the example of the sons of Levi, came to the point where their religion was strictly external. And they went about their religion with a certain veneer of orthodoxy, but inwardly they were bent on other things. But God's prophets, like Malachi, did not surrender to that compromise. They were all looking forward. They were looking forward to the day of which we read in this passage when the true successor to King David would arise to set right all that had gone astray. Now, as we have observed, the Old Testament prophecies of the coming of Messiah often had both of his advents in view. And that is the case in the text that we have before us this evening. It's a text that follows on from what we considered in our last message in this series on the great challenge of verse 2. Who may abide the day of his coming? Who shall stand when he appeareth? We didn't really dwell upon the latter part of that verse. He is like a refiner's fire and like fuller's soap, because really that is the thought that goes with the text that we have before us this evening. This is the great work that Messiah will do when he appears, a work of restoration. Not only would Messiah purify the sons of Levi in a literal, historical sense, but he would work in such a manner among his people at large that they would all be matched up in their state with the standing they had been given of righteousness before God. Clearly, the previous verse links Messiah's appearing with the work of refinement. And so we find in our text this evening that we come face to face with Messiah's purifying fire. I want you to think upon that theme this evening. Now, the image that the text sets before us is of someone who mines for precious metals. When you go to mine for precious metals, as those who mined for gold in the Old West, and I suppose some still mine for gold in the New West. But when you mine for precious metals, you generally don't go along and suddenly find a rock on the ground that is pure gold, or pure silver, or pure whatever the metal is. Generally, it's precious metal that's encased in some kind of ore. And the image here is of this one who has been mining for precious metals, engaged in taking the ore that he has found and clearing from it all the impurities that render it less valuable than the pure metal would be. The refiner of gold or silver sits before a furnace and looks into the furnace, and in that furnace, the work of assaying the metal progresses. He probes the molten metal carefully, removing the little flecks, the little pieces that are foreign matter. And eventually, when the metal has been purified, it glistens with a reflection of the image of the one who has been working with it. Now, for this work, and here's a thought that I hope that you take with you this evening if you don't remember anything else. For this work, the refiner must have a fire with just the right temperature. That is, the fire must not be so hot as to be destructive, nor can it be so cool that it doesn't do any good. It has to be held in a very precise range. And the one who controls that range is the refiner. The point is that when such truths are applied in the spiritual realm, the precious metal is the result of the work of the Spirit of God in His people. That is, we are not concerned principally with actual physical gold and silver. Now, if you come across some and you want to donate it toward the building project, we'd be glad to take it. But that's not what we're concerned with. We're concerned with that work that the Spirit of God is doing within us. The impurities are those things that cloud that work, that tarnish that work, that make it less attractive. We're talking about the impurities that we can otherwise define as sin. Unbelief. Corruption. These are the things that make the work of the Spirit of God less attractive. So the refining is the careful process by which the Lord removes those impurities. Many years ago, Job took note of this process. Let's turn back to the book of Job and chapter 23. Job 23. At the beginning of this chapter, we find Job saying, "Even today is my complaint bitter. My stroke is heavier than my groaning. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come even to his seat." And then in verse 8 we read, "Behold, I go forward, but he is not there, and backward, but I cannot perceive him. On the left hand where he doth work, but I cannot behold him. He hideth himself on the right hand that I cannot see him." So here's Job saying, "I don't know what's going on." Job is saying, I'm going through all these difficulties and I don't understand where God is in any of it. He said, "I look for him all over. I can't find him. I can't see him." But then in the words of verse 10, we find that Job is left where we must be left. "But he knoweth the way that I take. When he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold." So the process of refinement was going on in Job's life. Here's the thing about our text that we must get. The Lord tries His servants. Now, I've said before, and I'm going to say it again, and anytime I get the opportunity, I'll repeat it. The Lord tries His servants. I want you to see. Not to find out if they have any value, for He already knows that they do because He has worked within them. He tries them to make that more valuable, which is within them. He tries them so that they may understand the extent of His work within them And so these trials are not only for the purpose of refining, but they are for the encouragement of the people of God. Now, I want you to notice three things this evening about this purifying fire of Messiah. First, its target is dross. Messiah is not interested in refining out those things that are pure and precious. His fire is going after the things that hamper and hinder the testimony of his work. Now, there is the suggestion that we find throughout the scriptures that in the life of a believer, this refining process is always going on. It's lifelong. I know that the desire that many people have is to be set free from cares and concerns, not to have to deal with adversity. But adversity is part of this refining process. So that this process will only come to an end when the gold is pure. When he hath tried me, Job says, I will come forth as gold. When would that be, Job? When will it be that you will come forth as gold? At the end. At the end. Only when the gold has been made pure will glory be in the offing. So the fact that you are still here and the fact that you are still encountering adversity means that there is dross within you that God Himself is seeking to refine away. Now let's see some other references to the dross that is the target of this fire. Let's look at Isaiah chapter 1. Isaiah chapter 1. Verse 24. Therefore saith the Lord of hosts, the mighty one of Israel, I will ease me of mine adversaries and avenge me of mine enemies, and I will turn my hand upon thee and purely purge away thy dross and take away all thy tin. What was the imperfection in Israel? It was corruption. It was a departure from the commandments of the Lord. And the Lord said, I'm going to purge that away. And ultimately it would mean for Israel, the northern kingdom, and then for Judah, the southern kingdom, adversity of tremendous proportions. Let's turn to Ezekiel 22. Ezekiel 22. Let's look at verse 17. And the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, the house of Israel is to me become dross. All they are brass and tin and iron and lead in the midst of the furnace. They are even the dross of silver. That is, here are metals that might appear to be silver. But when they're put into the furnace, they melt away. Therefore thus saith the Lord God, because ye are all become dross, behold, therefore, I will gather you into the midst of Jerusalem, as they gather silver and brass and iron and lead and tin into the midst of the furnace to blow the fire upon it, to melt it, so will I gather you in mine anger and in my fury, and I will leave you there and melt you. Yea, I will gather you and blow upon you in the fire of my wrath, and ye shall be melted in the midst thereof. As silver is melted in the midst of the furnace, so shall ye be melted in the midst thereof, And ye shall know that I, the Lord, have poured out my fury upon you. Here was that refinement that was to be aimed at the people of Israel, who as a people had departed from the Lord. The Lord said the target of his fire was this dross of unbelief and disobedience. And that this was ultimately to be the work of Messiah was made plain in the ministry of John the Baptist. Turn to the Gospel of Luke chapter 3. Luke's Gospel chapter 3. Verse 15. And as the people were in expectation, and all men mused in their hearts of John, whether he were the Christ or not, John answered, saying unto them all, I indeed baptize you with water, but one mightier than I cometh, the latchet of whose shoes I am not worthy to unloose. He shall baptize you with the Holy Ghost and with fire, whose fan is in his hand, and he will thoroughly purge his floor and will gather the wheat into his garner, but the chaff he will burn with fire unquenchable. Here was an image from agriculture, taking the chaff away from the good grain and burning it with fire. But John's emphasis was, this is the ministry of Messiah. He purifies. This morning, in our message, we were considering the purpose of Christ in shedding His blood, in sacrificing Himself on the cross. We find that purpose set before us in Ephesians, the 5th chapter. It's a chapter often referenced at weddings, and so it should be. But a lot of times we miss the reality of what's being taught here. Ephesians 5 and verse 25. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it. Here's the purifying, with the washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church. Notice this, not having spot or wrinkle, or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. The purpose of Christ in relation to His church is to provide for the cleansing, for the purifying of the dross. Paul wrote to the Corinthians and spoke about building on the foundation, and he cautioned about building that is reflected in the materials wood, hay, and stubble. And he said that there will come a day of fire that will reveal the kind of work that has been done. And the implication, as I pointed out, was that in our lives, we all engage in building that is inconsistent. There's not a one among us whose building is marked entirely by gold and silver and precious stones. Our building is always mixed with wood and hay and stubble, and Christ is coming to refine that. Now, how does the Lord go about removing this dross? Well, He does it through the various trials that are designed to purge people, as we read in our text, as gold and silver is purged. That's the second thing that we see in the text. Its trial is cleansing. The purpose of the purging is not to create trouble. That is, the Lord's not sitting there saying, these people need trouble, so I'm going to give it to them. That's not the purpose that He has in mind. The purpose of the purging is to remove that which smacks of sin and unbelief. Now, this process is not an easy one. This process in which Messiah is engaged is not an easy one. Let's turn to Hebrews 12, probably the best passage that deals with this process. Hebrews 12. And let's look at verse 6. For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth, and scourgeth every son whom he receiveth. If ye endure chastening, God dealeth with you as with sons. For what son is he whom the Father chasteneth not? But if ye be without chastisement, whereof all are partakers, then are ye bastards and not sons. Furthermore, we have had fathers of our flesh which corrected us, and we gave them reverence. Shall we not much rather be in subjection unto the Father of spirits and live? For they, verily for a few days, chastened us after their own pleasure, but he for our profit, that we might be partakers of his holiness. Here's the purifying, the purification. Now look at verse 11. Now no chastening for the present seemeth to be joyous, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward it yieldeth the peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them which are exercised thereby. Wherefore lift up the hands which hang down, and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, lest that which is lame be turned out of the way, but let it rather be healed. Verse 11 is about the experience that children, well, I don't know if they have it universally nowadays, probably more so in days gone by, children have offended a parent, and the parent has decided that the child must be punished, and the parent says, now this is going to hurt you, it's going to hurt me worse than it's going to hurt you. I always wondered what in the world that was about, until I became a parent myself. No chastening seems to be joyous. It's never a joyous thing for a child to have to be chastised, to have to be chastened. But afterward, if a parent is faithful to chasten his child, afterward, what is yielded? The peaceable fruit of righteousness. And what we are learning in our text is that this is what Messiah does. He purifies his people. So the message is that we are to view this refinement as we view the actions of our parents who have labored to remove from us those things that would be to our detriment. There's one thing that comes to my mind regarding all of this, and that is the text tells us that Messiah will purify the sons of Levi. That is, here were these descendants of Levi who were to have been for the profit of the people. They were to have guided them in the right way. They were to have instructed them. They were to have done that which was right and showed them the way in which to go. And they hadn't done so. And even in the aftermath, as it appears, of the Babylonian captivity, when they came back to the land, they reached a point where the sons of Levi were once again not sticking to the Word of God. What does the Lord say? What does the prophet say Messiah will do? He will purify them. Now that gives me encouragement. Because that's saying to me, he's not going to let that go. He's not going to let them go their own way. He's going to purify the sons of Levi, removing those things that keep them from leading the people of God. So if he's going to purify the sons of Levi, what it shows us is that God is merciful to his people even when they slide back from him. His trial is cleansing. He's going to purge. And then thirdly, its triumph is satisfaction. Look again at our text. He will purge them as gold and silver, that they may offer unto the Lord an offering in righteousness. Now, the trouble was the Levites, the priests, it wasn't that they weren't making offerings. It wasn't that there wasn't worship going on. But it was a false worship. It was a worship that led the people to believe one thing while another thing was actually the case. The last part of the text reveals that the calling of the Levites was that they should be engaged in the service of God, and that they were to engage in that service in a pure manner. And the purifying fire of which we read here, the refining fire, was to render them able to serve the Lord. That was the whole point, to enable them to serve the Lord acceptably. Now let us turn to three scripture references in this connection. First of all, Psalm 4. Psalm 4 and verse 5. Offer the sacrifices of righteousness and put your trust in the Lord, that they may offer an offering in righteousness. What was the whole point? The sacrifices of righteousness were the sacrifices God had prescribed by which he was to be approached. Now there came to pass ultimately among the people a situation in which they engaged in all kinds of ceremonies and they had the appearance of orthodoxy. But there was nothing of righteousness about them. Turn to the 50th Psalm. Psalm 50. Verse 14. Offer unto God thanksgiving, and pay thy vows unto the Most High. And call upon me in the day of trouble. I will deliver thee, and thou shalt glorify me. Verse 23. Whoso offereth praise glorifieth me, and to him that ordereth his conversation aright will I show the salvation of God. What Asaph is saying here in this psalm is that the way unto God is through the sacrifices that are a recognition that there's only one answer for our sin, and that is in what Messiah has done through his blood upon the cross. We find this idea echoed in the New Testament in 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 4. Speaking of the Lord, to whom coming as unto a living stone, disallowed indeed of men, but chosen of God and precious. Ye also, as lively stones, are built up a spiritual house. Notice how Peter is broadening the application here. Not just to those who are descendants of Levi, but speaking to all the people of God. Ye are built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God by Jesus Christ. The offering up of sacrifices in righteousness is dependent on Jesus Christ. Notice verse 9. But ye are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, and holy nation, a peculiar people, that ye should show forth the praises of him who hath called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, which in time past were not a people, but are now the people of God, which had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. What is the point that's being made here? There is a satisfaction in presenting to God the sacrifices of righteousness. And how do we present those? Not by our own designs, not by our own imagination, but through Jesus Christ. Here was the message that Messiah was going to come. That Messiah was not going to leave things to go according to the design of the devil. He was going to purify the sons of Levi. He was going as a refiner's fire to deal with all that had become impure. That is the work that goes on within us now, that shall go on within us until the day breaks and the shadows all flee away. This is the whole point. Messiah will guarantee that ultimately his people all will be pure. It's a glorious thing to think that in the presence of God, in paradise, in heaven, there is nothing that offends. There is nothing that makes a lie. There is nothing that is perverse in the presence of God. How can we stand in the presence of God? Only as He purifies us by His refining fire. That work is now going on and will go on until the day when we are called into His presence. We don't know, we were saying this morning after the service, we don't know all that is true of those who have already passed from this life into the presence of Christ, but we do know this. They are in the presence of Christ. And we can add this corollary to what we know. They are pure. They are perfect. Because Messiah has purified His royal priesthood.